right. If anybody wants to ask a question or make a statement, just please make it short. We're going to go on for another half an hour to allow you to have a discussion.
Thanks a lot for speaking to us today, Dr. Greenstein. The question I had was regarding the recent statements from Netanyahu in the past couple weeks, talking about he advocates the peace and two-state solution, not mentioning the settlement. I just wanted to find out what's your position on that, how you feel about that, and also Netanyahu's position vis-a-vis the Lieberman.
Well, the question that was asked was, Netanyahu says that he favors a two-state settlement. These statements are absolutely, as everybody probably knows without me saying anything, these statements are meaningless, because it's a two-state settlement where? You can have a two-state settlement with Israel over 99% of the West Bank, and the Palestinians get a phone booth, they can hoist the flag in a phone booth, and they can call it a state. That has nothing to do with the two-state settlement as it's understood under international law and by the international community. The two-state settlement means there has to be a full Israeli withdrawal from the territories it occupied. And no Israeli government has ever acquiesced in that arrangement. My own view, for what it's worth, I don't see that there's any significant differences between an Avigdor Lieberman, a Netanyahu, a Tzipi Livni, or an Ehud Barak. It's all an illusion. Because the Gaza massacre, it was prepared and executed by Barak. It was publicly defended by Livni. It was said to be not enough by Netanyahu. There's no significant difference between these people in that particular issue. And we shouldn't have any illusions about whether change is going to come from the elected Israeli leadership. That's not where it's going to come from. I frankly think it would be a much better thing to put an end to this thing called a peace process, which only gives lots of academics and lots of whores a secure position, a lot of them Palestinian. Yeah.
Hello. Thank you so much for everything, and it's really great to be here. I just wanted to ask you to speak a little bit about the importance of the Golan Heights.
Excuse me?
Regarding a two-state solution and the 67 treaty or law.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about the importance, because you didn't mention it in your speech,
mm-hmm.
The importance of the Golan Heights regarding
Well, that's just another case of so much illusion. Everybody knows exactly how to settle the conflict with Syria. Hafez al-Assad, the father of the current leader, he was very clear. It had to be, and nobody disputes it actually, it had to be a return to the June 1967 border. Hafez al-Assad was very firm on that particular issue. Now, it's kind of hard to believe. I know it is hard to believe, and it's very hard to believe when you read the record. There's just this tiny, tiny strip in the northern Galilee. It's a few hundred meters, like a couple of hundred meters. And that's what separated the Israelis from the Syrians. Because Israel did not want to give exactly the June 67 border. And Hafez al-Assad said that border or nothing. And they fought over this area, which is like the size of this room. But it was obvious, at least I thought it was obvious what was going on. Israel wanted to inflict a tiny humiliation on Hafez al-Assad. It was purely symbolic, because it had no strategic value whatsoever. But because Anwar Sadat got back every inch of the Sinai. Some of you may remember there was a quarrel over this tiny, tiny piece of land. Who remembers what it was called? Taba. They quarreled, but Sadat was ready to break Camp David over Taba. He wanted every inch of pre-June 67. And finally it went to international arbitration and the Egyptians won and they got Taba. And Hafez al-Assad did not want less than what Egypt got. And Israel, not because they had any strategic value, which is ridiculous, an area the size of this room, but just to inflict a tiny humiliation on Hafez al-Assad, they refused. And they would call it Hafez al-Assad's mantra, M-A-N-T-A-T-R-A. I want the June 67 border. I want the June 67 border. Israel said no. Actually, it's kind of funny. Israel was willing to give them a little extra territory in the south part of the Galilee. So net, he would have gotten a little more. He said no, because he knew what the Israelis wanted to do, just to humiliate.
All right, thank you so much for coming out. I mean, I think it's really appreciated to have this discussion on this campus especially. I mean, one of the things that kept going through my mind towards the end of your speech was about the two-state solution. And I would want to hear more about why would you argue for a two-state solution going back to 1967. I think by your comments earlier about how the massacre and the conflict has been something that people have tried to depict it as something that began since the beginning of time, and things like that, and also alluding to South Africa as well, that having a one-state solution, in my opinion, a secular state, wherever you're Arab, Jewish, or whatever nationality or background you come from, can be something that people can live together. And I mean, again, talking about South Africa, there was an apartheid wall, and there's all the stuff where there's racism and segregation among, against racism, and black South Africans have been massacred by the droves, but at the same time, there's an actual state that was actually formed, and because of that, through activism, through things like that, and through a long struggle, that was able to be the case. And I don't think that if there was to be one secular state, like an actual true state, that there wouldn't be racism would end somehow tomorrow. But I think just some of the stuff that's been talked about for a two-state solution has made it so that basically there would be little Palestinian islands in some cases, the way it's been described. And that's inherently, I think, not equal. So that's...
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, there are several things. Maybe you'll just stay there because in case you want to respond. But let me just try to answer as best as I can. Number one, I was very careful in my remarks not to give you my opinion. I never stated an opinion on the topic. I simply told you what the international consensus is for resolving the conflict. That's what the international community has reached. That's its resolution of the conflict. Number two, you say, why can't we have one secular state? I'm way past you. I don't want any states. I don't believe in states, okay? I would like to see a world without states. I travel a lot. I always lose my passport. And for very personal reasons, I would like to eliminate that point where I have to present the passport and I enter a panic mode. So that's not the issue for me. I'd be very happy if there's no border between the U.S. and Mexico. Half of Mexico lives in my neighborhood already, so why not just eliminate the border? But, I'm glad they live there. Wonderful people. Why wouldn't I want Mexicans to live in my neighborhood? I'm serious. It's not realistic at this moment. That's what politics is. Politics is the art of the possible. It doesn't mean you have to give up on your dreams and your hopes. So you work towards a single state in Palestine, and you work towards a world without any states. But politics is what's possible and what's practical. I mean, I've been doing a lot of reading on Gandhi. And people used to say to Gandhi, okay, Gandhi, you're a vegetarian. why don't you make vegetarianism a plank on the platform, on a plank of the Congress party? He says, because very few people believe in vegetarianism. How can I make that a precondition for being a member of the Congress party? Gandhi says, I want to abolish alcoholism in India, and he has these big campaigns to abolish alcoholism. And then the people say, Gandhi, why are you focusing on alcoholism? Why don't you focus on also things like gambling, which is a real problem, horse racing, which is a real problem? He says, well, the answer is simple, because most people already agree gambling is wrong, but they don't agree that, yeah, I mean, most people agree alcoholism is wrong, but they don't yet agree gambling is wrong. And Gandhi says, I'm a practical reformer. That's what he always used to say. I'm a practical reformer. What's possible now? And this is what's possible now. It doesn't mean you have to give up. You know, Gandhi wanted to see a whole world being vegetarian. He wanted to see a whole world which is celibate. But, you know, well, he did. He was a brahmacharya. He practiced brahmacharya. He was a brahmacharya. Yeah, so it's what's possible. And one of the things I have, one of the problems I have with these one-state people is they somehow think, you know, once we have one state, all the problems are solved. Okay, South Africa has one state. It's true. And the average South African black person is economically worse off now than under apartheid. That's just a factual matter. Right now, the average South African black person is worse off than under apartheid. One state doesn't solve all the problems. It's a process. It takes time. I'm not wedded to one state. I have many Palestinian friends. I get along with Palestinians better than I get along with a lot of Jewish people. That's not the issue. The issue is what's practical and what's possible. And you can't achieve something, in my opinion, you can't achieve something in defiance of world opinion. You can't do that. You can only achieve something with world opinion on your side. And world opinion on this particular question is two states on the June 67 border. Not a Palestinian state with little islets surrounded by Jewish settlements. No. Part of the two-state settlement is a full Israeli withdrawal from the occupied Palestinian territories. But on those terms, I don't see any alternative.
Yeah, just real quick, but yeah, I mean, I think at the same time, though, people thought that slavery would never be abolished. Like, it would never end. And also, through public opinion during that time, not everyone in the world agreed with it. I mean, you can look at Brazil. Brazil happened, like, slavery ended way after, like, the United States. So it's like, I don't really fully agree with that. I mean, I think that there are lots of things that people say that's impossible. And even with South Africa, I mean, there's a whole thing there. Like, at least there, to a certain extent, there is some actual, like, being able to participate in politics. I mean, there's a whole lot of things I think there's to say, but I mean, I feel like that I agree with you that there should be a world where you can be able to go wherever you want, and it shouldn't have to be these borders. But I mean, I think at the same time, though, to actually go through and argue, like, to actually put forth a kind of two-state solution has, like, I mean, just looking at it, it seems that who would be on the stick, who would be on the end, who would
actually
have not even remotely.
Yeah, but you see, look,
I think that's something.
Okay,
that's
look. I have no illusions about a two-state settlement. I mean, look what happened in Timor. Okay, Timor is a tiny, tiny country. It got its independence after a horrific struggle from the Indonesians. A third of its population was exterminated in the first 3 years of its independence struggle. And then it got independence, and what happened? It became immediately dependent on Australia and neighboring countries. Look what happened to Vietnam. Struggled for 30 years. The estimates are kind of unfathomable. The estimates are 3 to 4 million Vietnamese were wiped out, were exterminated. And now it's just become a kind of dependency of foreign countries for cheap labor. We all know that we should be wise enough at this point to know that these are very small victories, but would Vietnam prefer to go back to being colonized by the U.S.? Would Timor prefer to go back to being colonized by Indonesia, and so on and so forth? I think the answer is no. And the same way, of course, it's going to be a small victory if Israel withdraws from the occupied territories. And yes, it will be trapped between Jordan and Israel and Egypt, and we know what that picture will look like. I know that. But, you know, that's the way the world works. I wish we could just snap our fingers and we would all be, we are the world. I wish. But that's not the way it happens. And we can only do the best that historical circumstances allows us at a given point.
I think that in the aftermath of the Gaza massacre, I'm hopeful for two reasons. One is that we saw Arabs and Muslims across the country come out in response to the massacre, and this is something that we haven't seen really since the beginning of the Iraq War, for fear of their very own lives in a country where Arabs and Muslims continue to be scapegoated. But the second reason is that the Gaza massacre has brought about a renewed call for the global boycott, divest, and sanction campaign. So, you know, two dozen universities, as you know, in Great Britain, and then as well here with Hampshire divesting, you know, it's an incredible achievement for our side. And I wanted to see if, you know, I was wondering what your impressions are of the boycott of the BDS movement are, and what you think the prospects are for us moving forward, and how, whether or not it can actually dismantle the colonial settler state.
Well, up until your very last statement, I was totally with you. The very last three words, colonial settler state. Up until there, I was totally with you. First of all, there's no reason for pessimism at all. I mean, of course, we have to be sensitive, and that's even a very weak word, to the fact that 1,450 people, their lives were snuffed out. 311 or so children were killed so Israel could restore its deterrence capacity. You know, it's horrible. And horrible doesn't begin to approach it. But the fact of the matter is, as the person who just spoke said, there has been a tremendous change in public opinion. Gaza was a turning point. In my opinion, it will be marked as the equivalent of the Sharpeville massacre in South Africa, which is the first main turning point in public opinion about apartheid South Africa. And the Gaza massacre will be remembered like the Sharpeville massacre. Israel crossed a red line. It's just gone too far. It's gone berserk. It's gone lunatic. And public opinion has clearly shifted. And you can see it in many ways. You mentioned the reaction among Arabs and Muslims, but you can also see it in the reaction in the Jewish community. It was the first Israeli war where there were no demonstrations in support of Israel by Jews. 50 people here, 60 people there. In New York, it used to be 300,000 they would bring out, like during the Lebanon War in 82. Now, by their own numbers, in a very nice sunny day, the best they were able to do was 8,000, and that's basically bringing in people from the, you know, senior citizens and kids from the yeshivas. It was a disaster for the Israelis. Too much of the truth came out. You know, if you're as Jewish or American, you want to go up front and defend dropping white phosphorus in the hospital? No. No, that's a very tough sell. Oh yeah, it was okay to drop white phosphorus in the hospital and incinerate children. Yeah. That's not, you know, you're Jewish, you're liberal, you like Barack Obama. You know, Barack Obama and incinerating children just doesn't seem to go together. And you saw it in many ways. You know, you take the case of Jon Stewart. I don't watch TV, but he has this thing called The Daily Show, which I suppose most of you watch. And, you know, Jon Stewart is Jewish, and when you get into positions like his, he's got a very nice position. You don't do anything that's going to rock the boat, because you don't want to lose that. Too much money and too much fame. But he has his finger in the air, and he knows what young people in particular are thinking. And he did a pretty brutal attack on Israel during the Gaza massacre. And he said at the end, you know, to be a Gazan is like somebody living in your hallway and having to ask permission every time you want to go to the bathroom. and it was a roars of approval from the audience. And then if you look at the blogs, the younger Jewish bloggers, the liberal Jewish bloggers, on websites like HuffingtonPost.com, Salon.com, American Prospect Magazine, go look. From day two, all of them, Ezra Klein, Matt Iglesias, Glenn Greenwald, they all came out completely against Israel. First time it's ever happened. Completely against Israel. You see the breakup everywhere. There are great opportunities now. There were huge, I hate to call it victories because there was so much death. But at the end of the massacre, Amnesty International did something it's never done. The most respected human rights organization in the world, Amnesty International, came out and it said, we have to institute a comprehensive arms embargo on Israel. And Hamas, but you know, what does Hamas have? A few, you know, firecrackers and Roman candles. Well, it's true. A full arms embargo. They call it a comprehensive arms embargo. Never before. They say no weapons to Israel, period. None. Zero. And they were very tough on, you know who they were tough on? They were very tough on the United States. They said, number one, the U.S. is by far, they said, the chief arms supplier for Israel. Okay. Number two, they said, I want to just quote them, give me half a moment, because it's very scary what they have to say. Number two, they said, the U.S. has provided large funding each year for Israel to procure arms despite U.S. legislation that restricts such aid to consistently gross human rights violators. That is, all the weapons that we give to Israel, it's illegal under domestic U.S. law. And then it said, quite surprisingly, coming from Amnesty International, Israel's military intervention in the Gaza Strip has been equipped to a large extent by U.S. supplied weapons, munitions, and military equipment paid for with U.S. taxpayers' money. That was Amnesty. And Amnesty, believe it or not, it went through one by one all the American companies, all the munitions manufacturers who made possible that massacre in Gaza. Some of you will be surprised to learn, as I was, every phosphorus shell that was dropped was American made. Every one. Every single one they found afterwards, they held up, you have the pictures and the numbers, all American made. And now you mentioned the boycott, the young woman who spoke. Well, now you have Amnesty on the side of a comprehensive arms embargo. No weapons to Israel, period, full stop. That's a very important victory if we do something with it. And the first thing to do is to educate ourselves. Read that Amnesty report and tell people, according to the most respected human rights organization in the world, the Nobel laureate Amnesty International, it's illegal for us to be sending weapons to Israel. And Amnesty says Israel has violated human rights laws so many times, it's such a consistent violator, that at this point, there should be no weapons to Israel, period, none. I think there are great possibilities now if we get off our behinds and do something.
You know what you just said? I think there's a lot of votes in general now, from the U.S. and the United States, and a lot of it having to do, you know, with this new administration, with the Obama administration. I'm wondering, I mean, what do you see? Obama's forces come out with all statements supporting Israel and even supporting what happened in Gaza. But I mean, what do you see as the prospect of, you know, a change in U.S. foreign policy happening, either because this administration is different, which is probably worse than the Bush administration, but Or because of what you just said, you know, that the world opinion or U.S. opinion may push Obama in a certain direction.
You know, from the Obama administration, you shouldn't expect anything. It's just holdovers from Clinton with slightly alloyed or sprinkled with holdovers from Bush. So it is. So there's no reason to have any expectations from the administration itself, but it is true that, you know, the U.S. is facing problems internationally and not only domestically. It's possible they'll try to reach for some deal with Iran, but the terms of any deal with Iran will be that Iran will have to cut off all support from for the Hezbollah and for Hamas. And Iran may do it. You don't know what Iran's calculation will be. Iran may decide, let's cut a deal with the U.S. and together control the Arab world, or they may decide that the U.S. is a declining power, Iran is a ascending power, and it doesn't have to cut any deals. It'll just continue on its way and gradually build power, and the U.S. power will gradually decline. But however you look at it, there's nothing in it for the Palestinians. If there is, the main factor is Iran now, and if there is a deal with Iran or a deal with Syria, it's going to be at the expense of the Palestinians. So we shouldn't be looking there. I think what we should be looking is looking among ourselves. There's changes in public opinion. It's long, it's arduous, I know that. But there are possibilities now. And we should, you know, we should do the legwork. And I always liked Fannie Lou Hamer. Some of you may know her from the Civil Rights Movement. And she was once giving a speech in the church. And she says that you can pray to God all you want, but unless you get up and do something, nothing's going to happen. And that's what, you know, we have to remember. You know, you can pray to God or pray to the Messiah Obama, but I don't care. That's not going to change anything. It's, you know, us that's going to change things if we, you know, if we act. And I think there are possibilities now. The Israelis, the supporters of Israel, they never even show up at events anymore. I mean, I speak all over the place. They never even come anymore. Because they work behind the scenes, that's true. They do everything they can to get administrations to prevent critics from speaking. I was barred from Georgetown a few months ago. Somehow I consider it an honor to be barred from Georgetown. And I was just this past week barred from Clark University. But in general, that's the only thing they can do. Because in the court of public opinion, it's a lost cause. You cannot defend what Israel did in Gaza. It was so ghastly, so cowardly, so satanic to drop that white phosphorus on a school which had 1,600 people quivering from fear and sought it out for refuge. Who's going to defend that? And so we have the whole of public opinion now to reach. We have great opportunities, unfortunately, because of the worst of horrors. But there is again a case where people should learn from the Zionists, and I mean that. No, I'm serious about that. You know, after the... Don't worry, it'll come on. Okay. After World War II, you know, 6 million Jews were exterminated, and the Zionists imagined the Jewish state would be Jews from Europe. They never thought about bringing in Arab Jews. It was supposedly for European Jews. Everything was destroyed. But did they hang their heads in despair? No. They redoubled their efforts. The most catastrophic horror that could befall a people befell the Jews of Europe. But they didn't hang their heads in despair. They got immediately to work. They started organizing. They redoubled their efforts. We're getting that state. Now, I know they did it with a lot of ruthlessness, which I can't support. I wouldn't support, and I don't want to support. But we should also take advantage, if I can use that term, of the horror that happened in Gaza and redouble our efforts, because we can win things now if we make an effort.
Dr. Finkelstein, it seems like with each subsequent Israeli administration, they build more settlements, more roads, more infrastructure, and land that's supposed to be for a future Palestinian state. And it's just becoming so integrated into Israel proper. And a lot of people are saying that it's going to be politically impossible for any future Israeli administration to pull out, and the political will won't be there, and it just won't be practical. It seems like, on the surface at least, that Israel's trying to destroy the prospect of a two-state solution, an alternative one-state solution for keeping apartheid indefinitely. I mean, surely they don't think they can keep practicing apartheid in the world with this. Sit by and let this happen. What is their end game?
Israelis don't have an end game, and I don't think most people understand that. Israeli policy has always consisted of practical efficiency combined with hope for miracles. So what does that mean? They start out at the turn of the century, the early 1900s. They're this tiny little movement, very poor, have no great power behind them, and they say, we want to create a state in Palestine. Well, how are you going to create a state in Palestine? First of all, there's an indigenous population, and it's part of the Arab world, and Palestine is a strategic crossroads. The British wanted, because it's the northern flank of the Suez Canal. How are you going to create a state? Well, they work very hard, they concentrate themselves, they discipline themselves, they wait. Maybe an occasion will occur and we'll be able to get a state. Lo and behold, 1917, there's a kind of miracle. The miracle is called the Balfour Declaration. Well, it wasn't really a miracle, because the Zionists worked very, very hard to get the British to issue that Balfour Declaration. It's called a miracle, and it was and it wasn't. It was in the sense of, who would have thought the British would issue it, but on the other hand, it only happened because the Zionists worked very hard. Okay, they have their first miracle. Then, after World War II, they want to have a state in Palestine. But how are you going to have a state in Palestine? We have to get a support from two-thirds of the General Assembly. Well, they work very, very hard, and then they have a miracle. Who would think? 1947 is the beginning of the Cold War. Both the Soviet Union and the United States, both, in the midst of the Cold War, the beginning of the Cold War, they both support the establishment of a Jewish state. Well, it wasn't really a miracle, because the Zionists worked very, very hard behind the scenes. They applied pressure on countries like Haiti, the Philippines, Liberia. Either you vote for the Zionists, or Firestone says, I'm going to pull my rubber factories from Liberia. They put pressure. They organize, and then they get the partition resolution. Then they have another problem. The state that Israel, that the UN creates in Palestine, believe it or not, the state they create for the Jews is half Arab. It's about 50% Arab, half 50% Jewish. How can you have a Jewish state which is half Arab? Well, then they get lucky. The Arabs attack in 1948, and they use the pretext of the attack to expel the indigenous population, and then what Weizmann calls, the first president of Israel, he calls the miraculous clearing of the land. Well, it wasn't quite miraculous, because they expelled them, but they had an opportunity. Then come 1967, the Israeli economy is crashing, more Jews are leaving than coming, it looks like the end of the Zionist experiment. What did they have? The miracle of the June 1967 war. Then come the 1970s. There's a real demographic problem in Israel. Arabs are multiplying too fast. What are we going to do? They get another miracle. What was the miracle? It was the miracle of Soviet Jewry. The Soviet Union begins to decompose, and they get to bring in a million Russian Jews, half of whom are not Jewish, but that's another story. They always thrive on maximum efficiency and preparation, plus waiting for a miracle to happen. So what you call, it's inevitable this or inevitable that, they don't accept inevitable. There are always possibilities looming over the rainbow, to solve the problem. That's how I think they think.
I want to ask you an opinion question on deterrence capacity.
Uh-huh.
And possibly the future implications of the elections in Lebanon and in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
What implications do you believe on Israel's deterrence capacity would occur if the opposition in Lebanon, and when I say opposition, you understand what I'm asking,
mm-hmm.
And an election of Hamas to greater seats in the Palestinian Authority, would that mm-hmm. have on the deterrence capacity of Israel?
Well, first of all, there is a question about whether the opposition, including Hezbollah, wants to win the election. There is speculation that it's such a difficult time now to be the government, the elected government in Lebanon, that the Hezbollah and the rest of the opposition doesn't even want to win. If they do win, I think it will put pressure on Israel because its legitimacy will be increased. And I don't... You know, whether they're in office or out of office, Israel wants to knock out the Hezbollah. It's a real problem for them. The guy, that guy Nasrallah, is a real... I mean, Nasrallah is a real quandary for Israel. Because I don't believe they want to assassinate him. I think that's not true. Because they know the party of God. You assassinate that man, and there will be something terrible that's going to happen in Tel Aviv. And I think they understand that. I think their intelligence is sophisticated enough that they know where he is and they can knock him out. But they don't want to. Because they know this is no joke. You're playing with this guy and you're playing with fire. When you see how the Lebanese Shia talk about Nasrallah, no, you don't want to mess with him. So I think they have a problem with him dead, and they have a problem with him alive. And I'm not sure if they know what to do about it. They got very close, you know, when they assassinated the fellow last year. But that was a warning. But they don't want to touch him. But I think they can. And you know what? I'm glad they don't. No, I'm serious. Because I think something terrible would happen. I do. That's why I think the Israelis are... They're losing it because they don't see where things are heading. That guy who was just knocked out of his appointment, Chas Freeman, who the Israel lobby got rid of because he said such terrible things. He said these really absurd things. He says Israel uses violence against Palestinians. What planet did he drop off of? You know. But he said something. He's a very smart guy, that guy Freeman. He was, believe it or not, he was Nixon's translator in 72 when Nixon went to China. He was a young fellow then. And then he learned Arabic. He's apparently a very bright guy. Probably a thug, you know, but he's a bright guy. And he said, I thought one comment he made was very sharp. He said, Israel is headed over a cliff. And it's taking us with it. And I think that's true. I think they're losing... They're completely losing touch with reality. I mean, remember in my remarks I quoted the Israeli strategic analyst who said this was not a war, it was not even a battle and so forth. He wasn't talking to us. He was talking to his own government because he says, folks, you're losing touch with reality. We did not win a war in Gaza. They're walking around, you know, Benny Morris, splendid Israeli victory in Gaza. There was no war in Gaza. It's as much a war as shooting fish in a barrel. But a lot of them seem to be suffering from this delusion, and it's a complete delusion, that they restored their deterrence capacity by their military victory in Gaza. And this is completely delusional. And they constantly, every day you open the paper, war, 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 war. The whole world breathed a sigh of relief. The NIE, the National Intelligence Estimate, said about a couple of years ago now, it said Iran has ceased its nuclear weapons program. everywhere in the world they breathe relief except Israel. Israel says, not true. We have to attack. You know, it's a crazy state. And I don't say it with any kind of glee. Unlike, you know, the woman who spoke earlier, I don't believe in dismantling Zionist colonial things. I mean, what is the United States? I mean, let's be for real. Let's not forget how we got here. You know, it was built on extermination and enslavement. So if anyone should be dismantled, I think we should go first, you know, by a wide margin. Not to mention what we continue to do in the world every single day. Let's not, you know, get so holier than thou that others have to be dismantled. I think most of the world, it had a vote. It would vote first to dismantle the United States, you know. But it is true, I think, to say that Israel has, to use in a colloquialism, has lost its marbles. And, you know, sometimes it may sound unpatriotic, but the best thing that can happen to a country is to suffer a military defeat. It is. The best thing that ever happened to Germany, was the defeat it suffered during World War II. It was the worst thing for the victims of Nazi Germany, but it was the best thing for Germany, because the German defeat broke the back of German racism, broke the back of German imperialism, and now there's no doubt that by far and away the most morally serious country in Europe, the young people in particular, are the Germans. That was a very healthy defeat. Now, some people may have said back then, you know, Germany, Hitlerism, we have to destroy Germany. And there were Americans who said that. There was Henry Morgenthau. And he said, we have to turn Germany into an agrarian country because it's so sick. You know, this Teutonic sickness, the German mindset, the Teutonic mindset. But in fact, the defeat was healthy for it, and it survived and went on to be, you know, a model, as far as Europeans can be a model, a model of a civilized society. And I think reasonable people would want to see the same thing happen to Israel, for it to, you know, sober up, because it's gone completely berserk. But I don't see any reason to want to see its destruction, if even for the most selfish reasons, because before it destroys itself, it's going to take a lot of the Arab world with it. It will be a ghastly, ghastly, ghastly scene. And there are a lot of you here from the Arab world, and you should think twice, three, and four times about it. It's heading in a very terrifying direction. And we should all redouble our efforts to try to pull back that car before it heads off the cliff. Because I think they're nuts.
Dr. Finkelstein, I was wondering if you could elaborate on how drastically you believe the prospect of normalization of relations between Iran and America would change or shift the balance in the region out of Israel's favor, and what would it mean for the region as a whole, in particular Lebanon and Palestine?
Personally, I don't think it's going to significantly change the U.S. relationship with Iran if there is some sort of accommodation between the U.S. and Iran. I think a lot of people don't understand this point, and, you know, even though I like John Mearsheim a lot, he's a wonderful guy, I think he gets this all wrong in the Israel lobby, he and Steve Wolt. Remember, the U.S. had a very close relationship with Iran from 53 to 79. We invested a huge amount of money in military hardware for Iran. It was part of the strategic triangle to control the Middle East, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. And then one day in 1979, that whole investment went down the drain because the Islamic movement came to power. with all the states in the Arab world, you can never predict tomorrow. You know, maybe tomorrow, God willing, Mubarak will be dead. And I personally, I know this is very Old Testament, but I don't want to be a death in his sleep. You can't. I heard 10 inshallahs in the first row. You can't predict with the other Arab regimes. The one thing that you could predict with Israel, because of its historical, its economic, its cultural orientation and so forth, is that whatever government comes to power in Israel, left or right, communist or fascist, whatever, it'll be a faithful servant of the U.S. And so for the U.S., that's a permanent asset for the U.S., and they won't sacrifice it for the sake of a détente with Iran. They may try to recreate what they did under the Shah, a sharing of power in the region between Iran, the U.S., Israel, and, you know, maybe, I don't know who else at this point. But I don't think, the big question is how much they'll give Iran and what price Iran will be willing to pay. My guess is the Iranians are pretty confident now that slowly but surely they're winning and the U.S. is losing. And so they're not going to be prepared to sacrifice the Hezbollah, Hamas, and Syria and everything for the sake of an accommodation with the U.S. That's my guess, but I could be wrong. And I'm sure there are other people in the room who have equally informed opinions, which are different from my own.
I'm one of those Arabs that think about that prospect every day of my life, not just once, twice, three times. The extinguishing of, or as I see it, the self-extinguishing of the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt that, at least in personal opinion, I don't think it's going to happen from the outset. My question to you is, if you can hypothesize how long the Zionist sort of manifesto and Zionist regime in the Middle East will in fact survive beyond today.
I don't think, honestly, we shouldn't engage in those kinds of scenarios. I don't see the point of them. We should be doing everything we can now to try to achieve a reasonable resolution of the conflict, always conscious of the fact that it's not going to be a solution. It's a step along a much longer process. But I think that, and with all respect, and I have no reason to doubt the sincerity and the decency of your point of view, there's a tendency to just miss the big picture. Look at what Amnesty said. The whole thing, what happened in Gaza, it was all made possible by the U.S., by us, the U.S. taxpayer money. That's what they say, and it's true. The attention has to be focused on what our government is doing and the fact that our government is primarily responsible for the horrors of living in Egypt, of living in Saudi Arabia, of the torture chambers in Jordan, and everywhere else. It's not Israel. What does Israel have to do with keeping Mubarak in power? Not very much. It's the Americans. Same thing in Jordan, same throughout. And the kind of focus on, you know, everything will be wonderful. Can you tell me what day will Israel disappear? It's just losing sight of the whole picture. I really don't think it's exactly what the Arab regimes like. They want you to believe that the whole problem is Israel, so they have an excuse to have alliances with the United States. You know, it's not Israel, it's really the Jews who are controlling Israel. No, I'm sorry. No Jews controlled Cheney and Rumsfeld. When Cheney and Rumsfeld decided to attack Iraq, they didn't do it because their great-grandmother was Jewish or because they had secret connections with Israel. Cheney and Rumsfeld, they're homegrown Americans. They went to Ivy League universities. They went to country clubs, most of which are very happy if there are no Jews who are members. And they did it because of U.S. interests. And about 1.5 million Iraqis were killed. Now, that's one estimate. There are many, but 1.5 million is credible.
But the Zionists weren't American.
Excuse me?
The Zionists who formed Israel were not American.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that that's not a part of the problem. But I think... I don't know what they are. They're hoodlums, that's all I know. But you make it sound like if you can give me a date when Israel disappears, then, you know, we can all celebrate and...
Absolutely not.
Yeah. I don't see it that way. I'm second to none. I'm second to none in being cognizant, aware of the horrors Israel inflicts over there. But where I suppose I part ways with you, I'm also very cognizant of the horrors which the U.S. inflicts there and elsewhere. And the fact of the matter is, what Israel does in 1 year, in terms of inflicting harm, death, and destruction, the U.S. does probably on an hourly basis. You know, that's just the facts. You take the case of 2002, the Israeli, what do they call it, Operation Defensive Shield, when they went into the West Bank. Okay, they killed around 50 people in Jenin. They killed around 80 people in Nablus. It was horrible. I have no doubt about that. It was horrible. But exactly at the same time, what did the United States do in Fallujah and Najaf? It wasn't 50 and 80, it was 500 and 800. Now, was Fallujah and Najaf different than Jenin and Nablus? The only difference was in scale.
But
I mean,
that's... that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yeah.
And so that's really the heart of my question, is that with this huge arsenal, this huge military arsenal that Israel has, as well as the United States, will eventually that same power implode on itself and corrupt
it? As I said, I think Israel is losing. It's lost quite a few screws. And I think that they're out of control. I do. I think there's a serious problem there. And that's why, as I said, we have to redouble our efforts to try to end this.
Several people had mentioned the Obama administration. It struck me sort of like in a positive light, but I don't think we should have any illusions that the Obama administration is a friend of the Palestinians.
I'm not sure if anyone believes that.
Well, I'm just raising it. Some people seem to indicate that, and I think there are big illusions in the Obama administration. That, you know, of course, they're, you know, right now escalating massively in Afghanistan, Pakistan. And even during the campaign, defending Israel. So, but I think, you know, the question that people, I think that we're grappling, that a lot of people were asking, and I know the week that happened earlier at the University of Maryland, this was a discussion. What is the, how do you get peace? And I don't think...
How do you get what?
How do you get peace in the Middle East? How do you get peace? I don't believe it is so easy. I agree. I don't think, though, it's so simple just to have a practical solution. I think it is going to take the fight for, you know, the way that you can organize between the Palestinian people and Jewish people who don't have the same interests as the Israeli government and the Israeli ruling class. There was just, you know, Israel is facing the same problems with the economic crisis that the United States and the rest of the world is. And it was just a wave of strikes.
I know where you're coming from, and believe me, I know every lyric to the Internationale as well as you do. And I like the idea of worker solidarity. And I can sing you every line to Solidarity Forever. Every single line. Me and Pete Seeger. I can do it. But it's not really... has any bearing on what's happening there now. 90% or more of Israeli Jews support the massacre in Gaza. The polls are pretty accurate there.
Yeah,
and it's a society that's consumed right now. It's consumed by real hate. It's regrettable, but it's also factually true. And the aim now, in my opinion, is you have to isolate those parts of, you have to organize those parts of world opinion which are willing to exert pressure on Israel from the outside. It's no different than what happened in the American South. The American South, you didn't try to convert. You didn't try to convert or create solidarity between whites and blacks in the American South. What you tried to do was organize those parts of U.S. public opinion which thought, for sometimes material reasons and sometimes for idealistic reasons, that the Jim Crow system had to go. And so, like, the demands of those in the American South were to bring in the federal troops to impose on white Southerners the end of the Jim Crow system. And it's the same basic principle here. It's just wishful thinking, the unity of the Israeli, Jewish, and Arab working class. Now, maybe in the future, but right now, it's wishful thinking. Right now, the aim has to be, as the woman said, I agree, the boycott campaigns, the arms embargo, and to force the Israeli Jewish population, not from any feelings of solidarity, but simply from the practical self-interest that this system doesn't work and we have to leave the occupied territories. I don't see any prospects now for solidarity. I wish it were otherwise, but I don't see it.
We did see it during the Intifada.
Not really. That's really, look, I lived through the first Intifada. I lived there quite a lot. As the person who introduced me mentioned, I wrote a book on it. The Rise and Fall of Palestine. I was there between 73 and 96. 87 and 93. I was there till 96, during the summers. No, you really didn't see that. What you saw was polls were showing that Israelis wanted Israel to exert more force on the Palestinians, that they thought that the policy of then Defense Minister Rabin, the force, might, and beatings, was not sufficient. They should escalate the force. I do think, however, that the nonviolent resistance has a prospect, but mostly over here, of Americans seeing the true picture of what Israel is doing. But it's just wishful thinking. You take the decent people there, Gideon Levy. If you read Gina Haaretz, Gideon Levy is the main Israeli correspondent in the occupied territories for Israel's most respected paper, Haaretz. And he was writing the truth. He was great during the Gaza massacre. And you should have seen the attacks from doves, Israeli doves. They wanted to throttle the guy. That's the truth. Gideon Levy wrote a column the other week. He said, yes, most Israelis agree. Most Israelis now agree. The Gaza massacre was a defeat. Israel didn't win. But do you know why they say it's a defeat? You know why? They didn't kill enough Palestinians. That was the problem. He said the attitude is we should have killed 300 or 500 more. That's it. That's literally what he said, word for word. The attitude overwhelmingly in Israel is, yes, we didn't defeat, we didn't win, but we didn't win because we didn't kill enough. And we have to be sort of realistic about what's happening. Not with any glee. I'm not happy about that. But on the other hand, I'm not going to blind myself with slogans about the solidarity of the workers of the world. and not see what's, you know, happening there. I was just in Oklahoma, and Oklahoma is very poor state. It's also the most diehard Bush state. I said, people didn't get, even at the end, that Bush was not serving their interests? And I said, no. They really believed that Bush was a Christian fundamentalist, that God appointed him, not as a joke. No, God appointed him. And they, it was completely against their interests. These are poor whites. But everyone was saying the same thing. No, I said, your father till the end supported Bush? He said, yeah. How could that be? And they said, well, you know, Oklahoma is the buckle of the Bible Belt. I mean, I wish it weren't so, but it is.
Thank you for speaking, Doc. As we've all seen on the posters and the t-shirts, just the slow disappearance of Palestinian lands. This may have been covered before, but what do you think is, in your opinion, I guess what will happen, what do you think would happen in Israel? What do you think they're going to do next once, I mean, Palestine gets to the point where it's not even a blip on the map or something, unfortunately, just the way it's going?
Yeah. You know, you can conjure doomsday scenarios. There's a possibility that, you know, Palestine will become an Indian reservation. I know that. It's a possibility. But there are also other possibilities, because I think Israel's right now in a very difficult situation. That Gaza massacre was a complete catastrophe for it. You know how Israel always likes to... I know, I have to get up. But Israel likes to denounce the UN Human Rights Council. How many people know that? Oh, I say it's composed of third world, Arab, African, you know, anti-Semitic, Holocaust denying, and all the rest. So what did the Human Rights Council do? They did something very smart. I have to give them credit. One of the leading judges in the world is Judge Richard Goldstone from South Africa. Highly regarded judge. He was on some of the International Criminal Court commissions on Rwanda, the former Yugoslavia, very respected, very moderate, and so forth. Richard Goldstone, he was one of 16 international jurists who signed a letter that said, I think what Israel did in Gaza has to be investigated. Now, Richard Goldstone is Jewish. Richard Goldstone sits on the board of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Richard Goldstone is known as being very supportive of Israel. And the Human Rights Council said, okay, we're appointing Richard Goldstone to head the Commission of Inquiry into what happened in Gaza. And now Israel is in a big mess. Are you going to say Richard Goldstone is an anti-Semite? Are you going to say he's a Holocaust denier? Are you going to say he's anti-Israel? But Israel knows. If he goes to Gaza, they know the verdict. Because Goldstone is not going to suddenly say Amnesty International, which came out with a report saying Israel committed war crimes. He's not going to say they lied. Human Rights Watch said Israel committed war crimes. He's not going to say they lied. John Dugard, who's considered the father of human rights legislation in South Africa, he went in an Arab League delegation, and his report's coming out in May. Dugard's a terrific guy, very honest, and we know what that report's going to show. And so Israel sees the writing on the wall. It knows what Richard Goldstone is going to conclude. And so now they're in a big mess. To admit him, disaster. To refuse admission, well, what do you have to hide? And they're in a very tough position there. And now it's our job to make that position tougher, to force them to be held accountable for what they're doing. So I think there are great prospects now if we take advantage of them. Good night.
At the outset, I said that that Dr. Finkelstein would show us how to be polemical and rigorous in your scholarship at the same time, and I think he has not disappointed us. The way to do it is to give your unvarnished conclusions and to back them up with unassailable facts. Let us thank him again, and I thank you for staying with us.